The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. 2018 marks the 40th anniversary of the first Ben & Jerry's scoop shop in a converted Vermont gas station. Back then, it was just Ben Cohen, the rootless art teacher, and Jerry Greenfield, the diligent pre-med, who were friends from middle school gym class. They figured they'd move on from ice cream in a few years when it became boring or unprofitable. But of course, history had other things to say. Today, you'd be forgiven for thinking of Ben and Jerry as more milk and cream than flesh and blood. But it was the real people behind the pints that emerged when the two joined me for a rare joint interview last month. Our conversation was taped in front of a live audience at the Flynn Center for the Performing Arts in Burlington, just a couple of miles from the site where Cohen and Greenfield set up shop in 1978. Please help me welcome Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield. I knew I should have gone into the ice cream business. Look at that applause you got. Look at that. You know, looking at your story and seeing your lives before you became these huge successes, you've been in each other's lives for a long, long time. You know, both of you grew up in Brooklyn, and then you met in Merrick, Long Island, where you met in school. Why have you stayed so close to him, and then you go?
I've just never run into a better friend to spend my life with. You know, he's kind of smart. He's funny. He has a real... He has very strange eating habits. And
such as?
Well, you know, the earliest memories actually I have of his eating habits is he was once attempting to survive on these one-calorie candies that his mom, I guess, packed for him in his little sandwich bag for school lunch. And we were in gym class together, and he keeled over. He fainted. and some kind of strange liquid came out of some facial orifice, and the coach covered it up with a gym mat so that he could show it to the nurse when the nurse came by.
In the movie version of your life, I'm going to have that kid run up and go, "Jerry, are you okay?" And he's like, "Yeah. What's your name?" And you're like, "Ben, my name's Ben. Thanks, buddy." And that's where we're all was born, there.
Yeah.
And you bent and down then, and got the...
You know, the second food memory I have of Jerry is when he was surviving on what he called slop. which was he would mix together cream of wheat and cream of mushroom soup. And he kept it around in this jar that he kept in his car, and he would kind of drink out of it. And
so for the record.
Okay. Thank God.
Ben created all the flavors. So.
Now, was the slop something that was consumed over the course of a day, a week?
I was trying to be healthy, and so I was. I have no trouble eating the same food over and over, day after day. I mean, it's just sort of.
He does not live to eat.
Well, no imagination.
I mean, he does eat a lot, but he doesn't care what he eats.
Let's talk about Ben for a minute, shall we?
Now, you love Ben. Tell us why you love Ben.
So we met, first of all, because we were both fat kids in junior high school. And, you know, we were not exactly in the mainstream of social activities. We were both kind of nerdy kids. And so we hung out together a lot, and we remained nerdy kids. So I think that was... That was
mushroom soup and cream of wheat qualifies you, I think.
And, you know, plus we always did like to eat together. I mean, we would have food together, and Ben was the first person who taught me about wet crunch and dry crunch. Ben's really into textures in foods.
Used to talk a lot about eating through the pain.
Right, okay. So food was a big glue in your relationship.
Very much.
Right. And when you say what's in the ice cream is his hemisphere and what's yours?
Well, I used to make it, but, you know, what's one of the interesting things, you know, so you think of Ben and Jerry's, you think of all these incredible flavors, and so people assume that Ben made some of the flavors and Jerry made some of the flavors. Yeah. Jerry, what were your flavors? And... It's kind of a long pause at that point. Right.
Slop. We had slop on the menu for a while. Yeah. No, but so you're the business end?
No, neither one of us. No, so, you know, Ben...
You roll a really good joint. I mean, what are you saying?
It's legal here, you know.
Yeah. Why do you think we're recording up here?
Ben came up with the flavors. I would make the ice cream. We started with this little shop right here in Burlington. And for those people who remember 40 years ago, about 2 weeks after we opened up, we closed the store because we couldn't figure out if we were making any money to stay in business. And we put up a little sign on the door that said closed. And we had an accountant who walked in the door and said, "Hey, I can help you." And so
to save that first shop.
Yeah.
But I want to go back before that, because in your lives, there's a lot of, you're going to go to college, to medical school.
That's conceptually right, yes.
You consider it. I'll take it. And you wanted to become a scholar, but you were into pottery.
Pottery.
And then you end up teaching pottery. Where again was it?
Those who can't do, you know.
Well, I'm glad you say that. Those who can't do make a lot of money selling ice cream. but you were, where did you end up teaching?
That was in the Adirondacks, in a town called Paradox, at the at the Highland Community School for disturbed teenagers.
But there's one section there, I think, where you guys are not in the same city, and you're not around each other for a few years, correct?
When we decided that we were going to make ice cream together, we were not in the same place.
And you were not in the same place for how long?
Oh, it was years, but we made a vow. So we decided we were going to learn how to make ice cream. Right. And so we pledged to each other that we were going to start making test batches of ice cream wherever it was we were living and report the results back and whatever. And
but I asked that.
I never made any.
But right.
We also made a vow that
we knew that,
we were,
Jerry. I think we're clear on that.
It should have been Ben. Ben was the guy who stopped doing his homework, in junior high school. I mean, I was the guy. I finished all my homework. I should have been making the ice cream.
Right. But I only mentioned that 5-year gap because this is back in the time where there are no cell phones and there is no internet. So maintaining that friendship, I mean, your friendship is integral to this whole
thing. We wrote letters.
That's what I was going to ask. Did you?
Well, we had a chain letter that we wrote to a group of friends. And, you know, each person would enter their comments and then send the letter around to the next person. And, you know, just kind of down circulating like that.
So you stayed in touch all that time?
I guess so.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't lose touch.
And what facilitated you getting back here and opening that first place in Burlington in the former gas station that you opened up in?
Well, I failed at being a potter. nobody would buy my pottery. And he failed at being a doctor. He couldn't get into medical school. So we figured we're not getting anywhere in the world, and maybe we should start our own business.
Did you know what kind of business?
Food.
Right. I mean, that's interesting. You didn't decide to go into, like, you know, the camping gear business.
Right. It had to be food. And we were originally going to open a restaurant. We had one friend who knew something about business. He said, whatever you do, don't open a full-service restaurant. If it's got to be food, open a very limited menu kind of place. And we wanted to live in a rural college town. So the idea was to take a food trend that was just starting off in the big cities, take it to a rural college town. And the food trends that were happening was bagels or ice cream. And we thought we would do bagels. And then
you couldn't make bagels either, could you? That's kind of like sculpting, isn't it? That's kind of like pottery. You got to shape it, you throw it into a kiln.
Right, right, right. It's a little more forgiving than pottery, but...
You effed up the pottery and the bagels, apparently. Yeah.
I was actually a baker's helper once, and I got fired, but...
And you were signed on to that? You liked the idea of a food business?
Yeah, because... We didn't know anything about anything. We knew we liked to eat. And I mean, you know, when you say a food business, we weren't really thinking about a business. For us, it was kind of a venture. Open up a shop, and we thought we would do that for a couple of years, and then we thought we would try something else. You know, we talked about becoming cross-country truck drivers together after that. So, you know, it's not
Thank
like
Thank God for all our sakes you didn't do that. You opened the first store in Burlington when? 78?
78,
yep. 70, and what was ice cream in America then?
Well, ice cream in Burlington was, you had the UVM Dairy Bar. and you had Seward's ice cream at the bus station in downtown Burlington. And... That was really the only...
Wasn't that enough?
Well, the bus station was a pretty seedy place at the time. No. Clearly.
And there was
not...
Upton's, the pinball parlor.
Oh, Upton's. Right, right.
They served ice cream also.
Now, for you to go back, when you were a child, what was ice cream in your childhood? Were you an ice cream person?
Yeah. We always had ice cream in our freezer, and... We would get half gallons from the supermarket, and it was just kind of a staple in our house.
What kind?
Breyers.
Breyers. Same for you?
Breyers.
Well, when I was a kid, because you talk about the beginning of the era of the super premium ice cream, people spending more money for better quality ice cream. But when I was a kid, you went to Howard Johnson's on the highway in Massapequa, where I was from, and they scooped ice cream, which was pretty good ice cream. There was Carvel. You bought Breyers by the container and took Breyers home from the supermarket, or you had the vendors in trucks like Mr. Softy and Good Humor was the big one on when I could be at trucks, you know, patrolling the neighborhood when I was a kid. And then we get into the era of, you know, Frozen Gladja and Häagen-Dazs and so forth. When you started making ice cream, did you say to yourself, this is who we are?
We just wanted to make the best ice cream we possibly could, and our... model was Steve's Ice Cream in Somerville, Mass.
What made a good ice cream?
He was one of the first homemade ice cream parlors on the East Coast. He was making ice cream in a 5-gallon rock salt and ice freezer in the window. And, you know, people were lined up around the block. There was a... There was a player piano on the line that you could, you know, put a quarter in and make the player piano play. And it was great ice cream. He was doing mix-ins, you know, so you'd get a scoop of ice cream, you know, vanilla, chocolate, coffee. You say, I want a scoop of ice cream and I want Heath bars mixed in.
Like Cold Stone.
And they would, right, right. They were the Cold Stone forerunner.
So in the beginning, what kind of menu did you have? Was it basic flavors, or were you throwing, you know, spare parts in there from the beginning?
Oh, we started with vanilla. We started with chocolate. We started with coffee. You know, the real basics. Ben had not yet flourished as an ice cream creator.
I think one of the first flavors we came out with that was a real knockout as far as we were concerned was cantaloupe. We made, I mean, it was great ice cream.
I don't see that on the menu anymore, though.
No,
what happened
no,
to cantaloupe?
No, you don't. I mean, the reason why you don't see it on the menu anymore is in order to make cantaloupe ice cream, you need overripe cantaloupes. And, you know, the produce wholesalers in town really liked us because, you know, we'd call up and we'd say, hey, do you got any overripe cantaloupes? And they just couldn't wait to get rid of the overripe cantaloupes. And Jerry would be scooping out, you know, the stuff that wasn't rotten and, you know, mushing up the overripe.
I absolutely avoided the stuff that was rotten. I did not use that.
And, you know, and it was great. I mean, it was it tasted just like a cantaloupe, except it was creamy and frozen, and but the problem is you can't do it in large quantities because not everybody would be there like Jerry, you know, scooping it out. You know, it's very much a hand operation.
So you come up with the flavors, and you're like, Jerry, cut and scoop those 500 cantaloupes, Jerry.
Well, no, not that with the cantaloupe. It was more like that way with the Heath bars. You know, at the beginning, we were buying Heath bars that were individually wrapped. And Jerry would line them, unwrap them.
Geniuses.
And line them up on a cutting board. And we had this big two-handled knife. And he would cut them, what, how many ways?
Thirds.
Into thirds. And then the other way? What, it was just thirds. So we were doing this, and it was our most popular flavor, and, you know, he was doing it a lot. And
and then, Jerry,
you know, we hired our first guy who knew something about business, and who is Chico Lager, by the way.
What's his name?
Chico Lager.
Lager like beer?
Lager like beer.
His name is Chico Lager?
Chico Lager.
Wow, that's the fakest name I've ever heard in my life.
He owned a bar.
Is his real name like Andy Horowitz? Is he like Ben Cohen, Jerry Greenfield? And if it was, have one guy with a different name, Chico Lager.
Chico Lager. And
what did he offer you?
He called up the Heath Bar Company and said, you know, we're using all these Heath Bars. Can't we buy them unwrapped? And they said, you know, we have boxes and boxes full of all these factory second Heath Bars that, you know, there's something slightly wrong with and we didn't wrap them. You want those? And he said, yeah, I'll take them. And, you know, it was a great deal in terms of money. And, you know, this guy, you know, he's an MBA. You know, he does his calculations and figures out the cost of money and the interest and all this kind of crap and ends up ordering like a ton of Heath bars, and he's got them piled up in the office behind his chair. And so we had to store them in the freezer so that they didn't, you know, melt or go bad or whatever. We had them stored on the top rack in the pallets in this walk-in freezer. And one day somebody went to get the pallet down and he dropped them on the floor before Jerry could cut them up. And we opened up the box and they were broken exactly right. And that became the new method of breaking up the Heath bars.
So for months after that, Jerry's in the freezer going, step back, Chico. Watch it. I tell them we're ready. Sweep them up. Let's go.
So you open up in Burlington, and it's 78. And when do things start to fizz a little bit? When do you think you're onto something? What's the sign that you're onto something, other than you're scooping a lot of ice cream?
It slowed down a little before we started fizzing.
It did. Why?
Yeah. It turned into the winter from the summer. And that explains why there weren't really many other ice cream parlors here in Burlington at the time.
Yeah. What did your competitors do during the long winter? Did they close?
Well, you know, Seward's was selling a lot of sandwiches and hot dogs.
And you didn't want to do that?
No, because that was the sign of an ice cream shop that was going out of business. They started to sell all this other crap.
What'd you do?
We started to sell other crap. We were selling
a discount on broken Heath bars.
We were selling soups and crepes. Actually, you know, Jerry was in charge of the ice cream. I was in charge of all the other crap.
Yeah.
And we don't sell any of that anymore.
And you decided. And you were deciding what that would be. You were the decider of that as well.
Pretty much. I think
Ben was our cook.
I mean, we discussed it together.
We came up with a great ice cream marketing promotion in the winter. It was called Popsid Bisui, which stood for Penny Off Per Celsius Degree Below Zero Winter Extravaganza. They all remember it. Everybody remembers that promotion at Ben and Jerry's.
The colder it gets, the more you save.
It's a miracle that you're up here with me today talking about your great success when you tell me that acronym. What is it again?
Popsid Bisui. Penny off per Celsius degree below zero winter extravaganza.
She had a screwy way of selling ice cream. Yeah,
we have a TV commercial that had Popsid Bisui in it. It put up each letter one at a time. P-O-P-C-D-B-Z-1.
Did you win some marketing award from some institution for that? Well, you would literally discount per the weather. And that's what saved you, you think?
No.
No, but one of the great things that grew out of that, so that was our first winter. We were really struggling. And Ben and I said to each other, boy, if we're still in business after a year, we'll celebrate by giving out free ice cream to everybody. Because we didn't think we were going to stay in business, and there was really not much there. But we were in business after a year, and that was our first free cone day, which still takes place every year. It's around the first Tuesday in April. You can get in line as many times as you want at any Ben & Jerry's shop.
And when do really things start? When do you look at each other and say, we got to take this to another level?
Things started getting worse. And so we said, we're never going to make it with an ice cream shop. We need to find another way to bring in more money. And so we started selling ice cream to some local restaurants that had asked for it. Ben became our route salesman. He would go around selling ice cream. And then he was passing by all these mom and pop stores that he was going by delivering ice cream to restaurants. And he thought we should package our ice cream into pint containers and he could sell it in there. And that is what started the business going forward.
Retail.
Yep.
It was stores. And what year does that start to take off?
1981? I don't know. We don't remember
right.
This.
Okay. Okay. But I'm just curious about right now it's let's not kid ourselves, it's a huge company. When did you go public?
We went public first just within the state of Vermont. The idea was to make the community the shareholders of the business. We had, you know, a bunch of venture capitalists that were approaching us saying they wanted to invest in the business, and we said, no, we don't want to do it that way. We want to use this need for cash as an opportunity to make the community the owners of the business.
How'd that work?
It worked out great. We sold out the offering. It was the first ever in-state public stock offering. And, you know, a lot of people bought stock, and happily the stock went up. A lot of people made a bunch of money. People's kids went to college on Ben & Jerry's stock.
What was unique about that was there was a very low minimum purchase. It was $126. So it was not aimed at sophisticated investors, it was aimed at everybody. So the Vermont offering was in 84.
And
then we had a public offering nationally in 1985.
Right, in 85. And then you sell the company to Unilever in 2000.
The company got sold.
We tried
to keep it independent.
Right, you did. You did. Now explain to people how that works. Meaning you have a board, and I just would assume a company named Ben and Jerry, and Ben and Jerry are alive, and I'm assuming that they're involved, they're calling the shots. How does a company get sold by your board if you don't want it to get sold to Unilever? How did that work out? I mean, in the end, you said that when things with Unilever are fine, it worked out well, but how did it get sold?
There was a CEO who was running the company at the time who saw a way for him to make a bunch of money by selling the company. And
Unilever was courting him.
They were courting each other, I think. And so Unilever ended up offering so much money for the stock, so much above what the price that it was trading at, that the board had no choice legally but to recommend the sale.
Right. Do they have other ice cream?
Popsicle, Breyers, Klondike.
Magnum.
Magnum.
Talenti.
Talenti.
Good Humor. They're a very big ice cream.
They've got every shelf of the freezer case.
If you like ice cream, you've probably already heard this one, but there's no better ice cream conversation in our archives than with Barbara Streisand.
I would have my pint of coffee ice cream, Breyers, and sit in my bed and dream. Go to the movies sometimes on a Saturday afternoon, the Lois Kings, where they had the greatest ice cream. And we also, well, yeah.
No, you're like me. Someone will say, what was the best part of the summer? I'd say, well, there's this restaurant that has the best coffee ice cream with chocolate-covered hazelnuts in it.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of that interview and many more at heresthething.org. When we come back, the skinny on Ben and Jerry's roles at the company after it was bought out by Unilever and the real story behind Cherry Garcia.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Now, more of my interview with the tycoons of Truffle Kerfuffle, Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield. The company they founded was acquired by Dutch conglomerate Unilever in 2000.
You're not involved. They run the company. You're not on the board. What's that like for you that your name is on it? Like I wonder, is you're still walking down the street and people are saying, I got a flavor for you. But they still think you're the pipeline. You're the conduit.
For the record, we love it when people come up and say, I've got a flavor for you. That we want that.
Right.
I was once at an event, and these two women came up to me, and they said, you know how, you know, girlfriends are always bringing over a pint of Ben and Jerry's to their friend who just broke up with their boyfriend to kind of soothe them? Well, we think you should come out with a flavor that's in a pink container called You Can Do Better Scotch.
What happened? I keep on
telling the company, this is a winner. You should come out with this.
What happened?
I mean, coffee ice cream with a butterscotch ripple. I mean, this is an incredible flavor. They say, oh, we got a flavor department. Go back, Ben. Go do whatever it is you do. That's what they say. What can I say?
It's one thing to enter a business, because I have no business sense at all. I mean, I have zero business sense. You know, when people talk about ice cream, it's, you know, a handful of flavors of which you're at the top of the pile. And I want to congratulate you. I mean, it's just amazing to have done that, you know, to have built a business and been that successful.
You know, we had a saying, Jerry and I, it's easy to make it lousy. It's hard to make it right. It's really hard to shove that chocolate chip cookie dough into the pints of ice cream so that each pint gets the right amount of chocolate chip cookie dough. You know, we used to slice open pint containers four ways into four sections to inspect the number of chunks of cookie dough that ended up in each section. And then in complex flavors like Heath Bar Crunch or New York Super Fudge, not only were you counting the number of chunks of Heath Bar, but you were counting three different size variations that all had to appear right. I mean, there's a reason why nobody else was making ice cream like this, because it doesn't really go through the machinery that easily. You know, there's nothing easier to make than a homogeneous liquid or semi-liquid like mayonnaise.
How many facilities do you have around the country to make ice cream? You're like plants that manufacture the ice cream.
Well, there's two here in Vermont. There's one in Nevada. You think that's it?
That's pretty much it.
They put it in a refrigerator, truck and truck it all around the country.
Yeah, in the country. And then there's another plant in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's about the whole thing, right? Ain't nothing else.
We're not
this
really.
This is the part you're supposed to know, Jerry. Okay? Yeah, yeah. He makes the flavors. You count the money, Jerry. What's going on?
Well, I think this just goes to show that Ben and I are not really on top of things. I mean,
now when you license, I'm assuming there's a licensing involved. What's the first signature flavor you come up with?
The first one, unusual one we came up with was Oreo Mint.
Oreo Mint. And, yeah. you got to cut a deal with Oreo.
Well, we didn't. And and then we got a letter from Nabisco, which owns Oreo. And they,
but it was on really nice stationery.
It was. And they explained that Oreo is their most valuable trademark, and they will go to the ends of the earth to defend their trademark. And under no circumstances could we call our ice cream Oreo Mint. However, we could call it Mint with Oreos. So we said, okay, and we changed the packaging, and they were fine. And then, you know, about, I don't know, 5 or 8 years later, we got another letter from the legal department at Nabisco, which began by saying Oreo is their most valuable trademark. So they will go to the ends of the earth to defend it. And under no circumstances could we pluralize their trademark. You may not call your ice cream mint with Oreos. You may call it mint with Oreo cookies. So, you know, we changed the packaging again and didn't hear from them until I started doing this online demonstration demonstrating the size of the Pentagon budget in relationship to the education budget and the healthcare budget and the alternative energy budget, etc., using stacks of Oreo cookies. Each Oreo cookie would equal $10 billion.
Yeah.
So I'd come out with this, you know, huge stack representing the Pentagon, and then you had this, these little stacks.
For A's research. Yeah.
And we got another letter from the legal department of Oreos saying, far be it from us to abridge your First Amendment rights of free speech, but we're getting a lot of complaints from our shareholders that the Nabisco company agrees with the point you're trying to make about the excessive Pentagon budget. Could you please refrain from doing that? You know, I felt that wasn't right.
But it's their cookie company, right?
It is their cookie company, but you see these advertisements where they're talking about some competitor and they're calling the competitor by brand name. And so I talked to a trademark lawyer and I said, what's the story here? And they said, you can use a competitor's name as long as there's no other product that will do to make the point you're trying to make. So I wrote him a letter back saying, look, I've researched every other chocolate sandwich cookie, and no other chocolate sandwich cookie has Oreo's high quality standards, and that in other chocolate sandwich cookies, the amount of white stuff in the middle tends to vary from cookie to cookie. And I'm sure they can understand how in my demonstration, each cookie equaling $10 billion was off by just a little, and I never heard from them again.
You can't take on the Pentagon using Hydrox cookies. I mean, come on. That's not going to work. So did you learn a profound lesson from your dealings with Nabisco? And you went on to do other flavors, Cherry Garcia, obviously. When you did other signature brands like that, did you get into more? Or did you get letters from a dear Mr. Cohen? The estate of Mr. Garcia would like to make it known to you.
In regards to Cherry Garcia, it was a flavor that one of our fans came up with. They wrote us an anonymous postcard saying, dead paraphernalia always sells. So, you know, it took me a long time, what, over a year, to come up with a flavor that was deserving of honoring this guy.
What year?
I don't remember years.
Well, okay. Was he alive when it happened?
He was.
Did he acknowledge what you did?
Well, his lawyer did.
You never met him. He never was like...
We sent him the first pint off the line. We overnighted it on dry ice. And his wife called up and said, you know, he can't have any right now because he's in the hospital in diabetic coma. But I really like the flavor. And then a few months later, we got a call from his lawyer, whose name happens to be Hal Kant. And he said, it's a really good flavor, but we think Jerry's entitled to a little piece of the action here. And we gave him a little piece of the action.
They made a little deal.
And now his estate occasionally argues over who gets the little piece of the action.
But you've been politically engaged your entire life?
Not so much. I think it's more after I moved to Vermont.
Right. What happened when you moved to Vermont?
Part of it was having gone to college. I went to college during the late 60s and early 70s. There were a lot of social movements going on at the time, and soon thereafter I came to Vermont, which, you know, it's just a wonderfully community-oriented state. You can go talk to your legislators in Montpelier. I mean, it's very down home, and there's a lot of grassroots activism here. And so I've become very supportive of the Progressive Party in Vermont. There's a third party here in Vermont. And, you know, plus, there's Bernie. And there is nobody like Bernie. Ben and I were surrogates for Bernie in the last presidential primary. And, you know, what's among the amazing things about Bernie, besides what he's been fighting for his whole political career, is that he is not for sale. And you do not find people in the political world with that level of integrity.
And what about you?
Junior high and high school, I wanted to go down south with the Freedom Riders, and my parents wouldn't let me. So, again, during that same period of time, I grew up on Long Island. My parents would every once in a while drive into New York City, and we would drive over the Triborough Bridge, and you get let off at 125th Street. And on one side of the street, there's dilapidated housing and people living in poverty, and on the other side, there's people living in wealth. And it didn't seem right to me, and that affected me quite a bit. I think it was Desmond Tutu who said that in situations of injustice, you cannot be neutral. If an elephant is standing on the tail of a mouse, you can say you're neutral, but the mouse will not appreciate your neutrality. When being confronted with injustice, you have three choices. You can either ignore it, you can complain about it, or you can do something about it.
Did you guys set up a charitable foundation for the company, or do you guys have your own foundation that you funnel money into from individually or from the company?
All of the above.
What's the mission? What do you target mostly? Income disparity, the arts, what are you doing?
Well, so for the Ben & Jerry's Foundation, it's social justice and grassroots organizing for that. And the interesting thing about the foundation at the company is that the final decisions about where the money goes is done by employees who volunteer their time to make those decisions. And they are remarkable. They do an incredible job.
But I think what's important to understand is that, the major effect that Ben & Jerry's has and the major contribution that Ben & Jerry's has to society is not about the foundations. It's not about donating money. It's about integrating those social concerns into our day-to-day business activities and using the business's voice.
So going back to the public sale in Vermont.
Certainly that. And I'm also talking about speaking out on social and political issues.
And we're going to get to campaign finance reform and protest about, you know, all kinds of things that are worrisome in this country that people have been led to believe it's ineffective. And it is not ineffective. If you see something wrong in this country, you need to scream as loud as you possibly can. You've got to protest. You've got to demonstrate. You've got to get active.
It's the patriotic thing to do.
They're there working for you. I'm in a room with congressmen and senators, and I'm looking at them like, you know, you're on the clock, buddy. Campaign finance reform. It is the linchpin of every problem. How'd you get involved with that issue?
I was working for a long time on shifting budget priorities from the Pentagon to social needs and didn't get anywhere. I think a lot of that reason was because of so many defense contractor political donations. So that was one factor. And then Jerry and I were both active in the Occupy Wall Street movement. Originally, it was laser focused on economic disparity, but as it started broadening and everybody who was protesting whatever came into that movement, the message started to get garbled, and I felt like it was important to focus. And the common denominator between healthcare and issues of the environment and energy independence and Wall Street banks, the common denominator was money and politics. Mm. That all these corporations and high wealth individuals are paying Congress not to pass laws that protect people, but to pass laws that protect corporations. So I got into working to get money out of politics.
You see the tax cut to put more money into the bank accounts of a class of people, typically GOP supporters, who, if it's a significant amount of money for these people, you see where Kushner paid no taxes all these years, and the Democrats, I want to win the midterms just because I want to see Trump's tax returns. You know, they announced they're going to get their hands on his tax returns. And that'll be thrilling. Okay. We just have some mind-blowing questions from the audience. They're really just great questions. Someone actually wrote down, they wrote, vanilla or chocolate? No, that wasn't a question. We went over some of the questions backstage to see which ones they have not been asked, 50 billion times before. But I love this one, which is, you hold your answer. You go first, because I know your answer. What's the longest you've ever gone without eating ice cream?
I have gone months without eating ice cream.
Really?
I would probably say 2 or 3 months.
You've gone 2 or 3 months.
And then what happens?
Right. And they find you in a pile on the ground in a pool of tears?
I'm a feast or famine kind of. I have a freezer at home that's got
a couple hundred pints in there?
Several gallons.
As it should be.
Yeah, because you never know when someone's going to drop by and is looking for...
Well, if I came to your house and you didn't have any ice cream there, I would beat the crap out of you.
I mean, this guy says he's gone several months. All I know is that every once in a while, he comes to me kind of sheepishly and says, I ate 2 pints last night.
We were very, very... self-disclosing backstage about our ice cream fantasies.
I mean, what's the worst sound in the world?
That spoon scraping the bottom
of that. That's it! I didn't even prep him on that.
I told you, at the height of my ice cream addiction, I'd be sitting I was divorced, I'm living by myself, I'm miserable, and what's better medicine than a pint of ice cream? And I'd be sitting there watching CNN, and I'd be like, 9 o'clock, it's almost 10 o'clock. I mean, all of a sudden I hear that scrapey sound, I'd be like, no, how did that happen? Wait a minute, I didn't eat that whole thing myself. That's not possible. What's the longest you ever went without ice cream?
A couple of weeks. Maybe 1 week.
Maybe 1 week. Speaking of getting screwed, I really probably should come up with a question that's not unkind to Republicans. Applaud in this house if you're a Republican. If you're a Republican. Are there any Republicans here? Applaud if you're a Republican. We have 4 Republicans in this building. I love this town. I love this town. There's 4 Republicans here. What do we do if the Democrats don't take control? What are we going to do?
You know, I have a new life philosophy. Lower your expectations, but assume the best. It's a fine line. And I'm assuming the best.
I think we've already lowered our expectations. As low as they can possibly go. Okay.
How do you learn to stick your lips out like that? I mean, do you do exercises?
It's funny you say that. They came to me and they said, I was going to do a movie. And they said, do you want to play Trump? Lauren called me. Lauren's my dear friend. He said, you want to play Trump? I said, are you out of your fucking mind? I don't want to play Trump. I said, who the hell wants to do that? And I was going to go do a movie. Then the movie fell apart. And I called up Lauren. I go, all right, I'll come do Trump. He's like, and literally the joke is, he goes, it's three shows. We're going to do three shows before the election, and then he's gone. And it's going to be fine. It'll be great. So I'm like, all right, what the hell? I do it for three shows. And then, oy vey. And then, and I said to myself, for the cold opening, it's fast, it's brassy, we're firing the cannon, it's in front of a live audience, even though we're on TV. It's like, I want to make this, in one sense, as two-dimensional as the man himself is. You know? And so I said to myself, you have to raise your left eyebrow like this, and then sometimes try to stick your mouth out as far as you can, like you're trying to suck the windshield out of a car. And just make it completely stupid. I mean, make it silly and stupid, because it's not, you know, if we did the really finely etched one, that's a David Fincher movie, so we're not going to be doing that. Who do you think is the Democrat that can beat Donald Trump?
Bernie!
You guys are loyal. You too? You're Bernie. Boy, you guys are something else. Now, I love this question. How do you feel Ben and Jerry's has shaped the culture of Vermont?
You know, I think before Ben and Jerry's, Vermont was pretty much known for maple syrup. Interestingly enough, I think after Ben and Jerry's, I think there started to be all these other specialty food companies, great cheese companies. The name Vermont came to stand for really high quality specialty food products.
I think Vermont is known as entrepreneurial, partly as a result of Ben and Jerry's. I think because of many things, including Bernie Sanders, Vermont is seen as progressive. And one of the remarkable things about Ben and Jerry's is that even after it was sold to this giant multinational, and even after Ben and I have nothing to do with the company, the company continues to be incredibly outspoken about really serious issues, like it's publicly supported Black Lives Matter, it's publicly supported gay marriage, it's publicly supported Occupy Wall Street, which is essentially an anti-corporate thing. And what's so wonderful about it is Ben and I have nothing to do with that. It's the company itself and the values.
It worked out well. The sale.
You know, it's about the people. You can say all you want about agreements and whatever. It's about the people involved, and the people at the company are incredible.
That's great. The last question I have, then a comment, is that your wife is a psychologist.
Yeah.
And did that play an important role in your success? I just had this image of, like, you in bed with your wife, you're at the kitchen table, like, Ben, you call Jerry. And you tell him you're sorry.
I called Ben this morning just to say hello.
And then he called me this afternoon to ask, what are you wearing tonight? And I said, you know, I'm going to be wearing a button-down shirt and some jeans. And he said, oh, I was going to wear a jacket. And I said, no, we can just be ourselves. I mean, you know. And then I proceeded to get dressed up in my button-down shirt and my jeans. And my dear wife said, you're not going to go like that, are you? So I said, okay, you want the jacket? And she said, yeah, that's a lot better. So I had to call Jerry up and say, no, I'm going to wear the jacket.
Well, let me just say that, you know, I think it's amazing to sit with the two of you who, A, are synonymous with a product that people really enjoy and love. I mean, who doesn't love ice cream? And B, your incredible friendship. I mean, learning about you in some more detail about what a great friendship you've had, but also what great citizens the two of you are and what you've done with this company. Incredible. Incredible. Let's hear it for Ben and Jerry.
Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield. They invented cookie dough ice cream, Heath Bar Crunch, and many, many more. But one flavor they didn't invent is s'mores. That one comes to us from the fevered imagination of a man who might sound familiar to Here's the Thing listeners, our engineer, Zach McNeese, and his mother, Sandra. They submitted the idea of s'mores ice cream to Ben & Jerry's in 1991. Now, every year, hundreds of coupons for free pints arrive in the mail from Vermont. Nobody asks. They just come. Ben and Jerry are men of their word in commerce as in friendship. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Technical production by Zach S'mores McNeese. Thanks to Vermont Public Radio.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in business into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.